This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Some people make such an impact that they're only known by one name.
Say my name, say my name. No one is around you. Say, baby, I love you. You ain't running game. Say my name.
That name, of course, is Beyoncé. Beyoncé Knowles Carter these days. Here she is singing the lead with the girl group Destiny's Child. In her career spanning two decades, she's acquired more than 20 Grammys, a reported net worth of more than $350 million, a history-making headliner set at Coachella, a September cover of Vogue magazine with unprecedented editorial control, and of course, a sound that is all her own.
That Creole make a Texas Bama.
Beyoncé obviously has a legion of fans around the world. If you're one of them, we are looking forward to hearing from you. But this conversation is about more than fandom. It's about finance, about business, about what it takes to truly control your destiny. More creative professionals are taking the reins and exerting more influence over their career paths these days. How much does Beyoncé reflect that trend? And in what ways is she the trendsetter? We'd love to hear from you, especially if some of her career moves reflect your own. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us from NPR in New York is Fridera Hadley, a visiting assistant professor of ethnomusicology at Oberlin College. Fridera, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also joining us from NPR in New York is Soraya McDonald, a culture critic with The Undefeated. Hi, Soraya.
Hello again.
Joining us from WFDD Public Radio in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is Candace Marie Benbow, a freelance writer and educator. Candace, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
And here with us in studio is Kimberly Adams, a senior reporter with Marketplace. Hi, Kimberly.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Soraya, so let's just get one thing out the way real quick that is reflected in a comment from John. John emailed, "No offense to Beyoncé, but seriously, can you please talk about something that matters? She is of no consequence to me or anyone I know, will not do anything for me or anyone I know, will change no laws, will lift no generation out of poverty, cure any disease, or stop any wars. So why do you waste valuable policy airtime on her? Leave her to access Hollywood or Entertainment Tonight." First of all, John, I don't know if you heard the hour we just did on the plight of the Rohingya Muslims today, or the hour we did yesterday on the importance of the prison strike going on and what it's like working behind bars today, or maybe the hour we did about regular order and John McCain's call for bipartisanship. But I think we got that covered. However, I do take John's point. Why is Beyoncé worth talking about?
So I think there's a couple of things to point out there. One, it's a little preposterous to hang the responsibility for changing, you know, the entire world, as well as sort of hundreds of years of just bad politics and white supremacy and all the things that your caller just mentioned as being more substantial. Like, we wouldn't hang that on the shoulders of any one person, because, you know, otherwise I would imagine these things would all be fixed by now. That said, that doesn't mean that what Beyoncé represents and the things that we talk about when we talk about her are not important, because, you know, first and foremost, Beyoncé is an artist, and art is political. It has a significant function in our society in terms of the way that we process what's going on around us and how we understand it and how we communicate ideas and feelings about those things. And Beyoncé brings that up a lot because she is one of, I mean, she's basically, you know, the most recognizable Black woman in the world, I think, aside from Oprah, probably. And people have very sort of specific feelings and attitudes toward her as a Black woman, period, especially someone who's so visible. But the other thing that I want to make sure that people are cognizant of is that, like, Beyoncé is clearly aware of her sort of power within the culture wars and politically. That's something that she's shown tremendously in the past few years.
Right.
So when you see, you know, a performance at the Super Bowl, right, which is like one of the biggest sort of televised stages of the year, and she is paying homage to the Black Panthers. It's difficult to say that, you know, Beyoncé is just apolitical, or when you have a video like the Formation video where she's clearly referencing police violence toward unarmed Black people, when she's referencing basically the way we just sort of threw people away after Hurricane Katrina. All of those things converge in her art.
Well, and I did want to get some more. I do want to get some more into that as we continue. But Fredera Hadley, I should say, by way of context, this conversation was started by the September cover of Vogue magazine. Can you give us a little context for that and for kind of what that's about?
Yes, I think Vogue is an iconic publication that represents, you know, what we think, what society thinks of as high fashion in a space that has been difficult for Black women and women of color to really penetrate, both sort of the editorial world that Vogue represents and the larger fashion world that it represents. So to have Beyoncé, who is unapologetically a Black woman, have such control over the shape of its most important issue is substantial. And to be able to, not just that she is a Black woman, but that she consciously evokes her Black womanhood in everything she does. And so I think at the announcement of her her involvement with that issue, people were, Black women specifically, were overjoyed because we knew that we would somehow show up in that issue, not just Beyoncé's very, very beautiful photos and her moving narrative about herself. And I think part of that, that for me was so resonant, is how she chooses, and is indicative of how she chooses to manipulate media to her advantage. And I don't mean manipulate in some sort of negative connotation, but really understand how media works and right. and to eschew some of the trappings that media has set for Black artists in the past.
Kind of knowing which strings to pull.
Exactly. And so the idea that she wanted to present her statement, not in a traditional interview format, but sort of, you know, from her with the help, I think, of a writer, but that's fine, and communicating what she had to say. And she has shown us over and over again that what is most important to her is communicating to us most directly, most clearly. And this time she was able to take one of the most iconic publication brands and still do that. And I think that is a major accomplishment, on top of the fact that she's the first Black woman to have this kind of access. The way she was able to use that situation to make sure what she wanted to come across with, the message she wanted to convey, came through unadulterated.
Could I add something?
Briefly, please.
Sure. So I just want to point out that, you know, in talking about the Vogue cover specifically, basically, like, the three most important components of that package, which is the photographer, the subject, Beyoncé, and then the person who did the interview, which is the fabulous Clover Hope from Jezebel, are all African-American. Mm-hmm. And that does not happen, like, without Beyoncé's say-so and direct input.
Let's talk a little bit more about that say-so, Kimberly Adams. For a long time, she was managed by her father, Matthew Knowles. She decided to manage herself right before her album 4 came out. Here she is talking about that process.
It's very difficult managing myself. Every night when I go to sleep, I ask hundreds of questions, but I'm learning so much. And I'm making mistakes, and I'm learning from them, and I'm not afraid to make a mistake. I embrace mistakes. They make you who you are. I've never been afraid to fall, so. And I say all these things, but now I'm getting tested.
What about the business aspect for her, Kimberly Adams? How did that change after she started to manage herself? Even she kind of refers to this learning curve that she had.
Well, I think she's like many CEOs that see their businesses grow and develop and change. You get pushback and you change your business and how you run it as a result. I think because she is such a notable singer and performer and celebrity, people don't always think of her as a businesswoman. But if you actually put it in context, you know, she started Parkwood Entertainment in 2008 when she decided to manage herself. She now produces movies, her own videos. She has a talent management aspect of it. She has her own clothing lines, fragrances, endorsements. manages hundreds of staff and employees, is clearly the queen of the non-disclosure agreement. And she runs her business all about that control that you said and that she referenced in her own commentary, that she wants to be in charge of her image, of her business, of the money that she makes from her business. And she uses the authority that she has from her space in this society and her popularity and her celebrity to manage her business kind of however she wants, in a rather odd way, especially when you consider the relationship to the media and the fact that she doesn't do interviews anymore. It's almost like President Trump, where he goes around the media often and speaks directly to people. Beyonce speaks directly to her fans through whatever form she chooses.
I know we have to pause in just a moment, but Candace Marie Bembo, did we notice a shift in her artistic style and her musical style after she parted ways with her dad?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that you can look back to the album 4 and see the trajectory shift, right? You have much more of, she has much more of a hands-on perspective and approach to, one, the music, to the production, to the access. A lot of people want to just look at the Surprise album that, again, without question, changed and transformed the music industry. But you really see her taking 4 as that particular album as her entrance to say, this is a new Beyonce, this is a new sound, and I'm moving towards owning my own sound and my own craft as much as possible.
We'll continue this conversation momentarily with Kimberly Adams, Candace Marie Bembo, Soraya McDonald, and Fridera Hadley. Kiana emailed from me, Beyonce is the embodiment of the fierce version of myself that lives in my head. I hear that, Kiana. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you. The Beehive is buzzing today on 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing the business of Beyonce, Beyonce Incorporated, perhaps, with Kimberly Adams, senior reporter for Marketplace, freelance writer and educator Candace Marie Bembo, Soraya McDonald, culture critic with The Undefeated, and Fridera Hadley, a visiting assistant professor of ethnomusicology at Oberlin College. We would love to hear from you as well, particularly if she has had an impact on you in the way that you pursue art or the way that you do business. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Robert tweeted, it wasn't that long ago that black artists and sports players were confined as to say so. They had great limits of what they could say about social justice issues of their day. Still an issue, as we see currently in the NFL. The Beehive is also a buzz and taking on some of the critics online. One listener wrote on our website, the1a.org, a bunch of men here in the comments discussing Beyonce and her music who know nothing about Beyonce and her music. Y'all be clueless on why Beyonce, who is a musical and marketing powerhouse, is relevant and what she projects to young black girls and women in the U.S. and the world over. Another listener wrote on our website, hey, it's all about marketing a rarity. There's only one Beyonce, just as there's only one Diana Ross or Rod Stewart. Enjoy them while they're here. Soraya McDonald, is that kind of the crux of it? How much of this do we put in terms of the business story of Beyonce as a remarkable story about a black woman who has found success, as opposed to just a superstar, someone who is immensely talented and would get this kind of carte blanche regardless of who she was or what she looked like?
Well, I don't think you can really separate those two things because, you know, there have been a few other stars who have sort of reached this like upper echelon of celebrity in the way that Beyonce has. I mean, Aretha Franklin comes to mind. She's sort of the prototype for someone like Beyonce, particularly when you're talking about sort of marrying this outsized talent with a dedication to social justice and uplifting black people. I think what's significant about Beyonce is the control that she has, that she's exerted over her career and her image and her intellectual property and everything around that is really quite revolutionary for her, for black women in general. Because, I mean, if you just go back to Aretha, This is a woman who saw so many of her colleagues in the music industry getting taken advantage of in one way or another, to the point that she basically demanded that she be paid in cash before she performed, and then she would take her purse on stage with her. And so, you know, when you think about someone like Beyonce, who is basically sort of doing, you know, an MBA, but in life, as she's kind of figuring this out as she's going along, and understanding herself to be her own little microeconomy and what that means in terms of not just all the people who she employs who depend on her, but also like hanging on to that wealth. And that's something that she's clearly cognizant of because she sings about it. She raps about it, right? Like, you know, I think on the latest single that she and Jay-Z released, can I say Ape? No. Ape? I'll just say Ape.
Yeah, we'll just keep it clean. This is NPR after all.
Yes. Right, like on the latest song that they released, which they, you know, recorded the music video for in the Louvre, you know, she's talking about how her grandchildren are already wealthy, right? Like, this is something that she's clearly put a lot of thought into. And I don't think it's just a matter of like stack your paper, you know.
Right.
There's something much more significant there. And I think one of the things that comes up a lot in conversation about Beyonce and about Jay-Z is sort of these unapologetic capitalists, is that for women and for women of color in particular, being able to make your own money determines like how much freedom you have.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways.
We did get a comment to that effect. By the way, since you mentioned Aretha Franklin, it is worth noting that the public memorials to Aretha Franklin began today. Her body is lying in repose at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit today and tomorrow. Then there'll be a public concert on Thursday before her funeral on Friday. But regarding your comment that you just made, Nancy emailed, "I too was thinking, what? Beyonce? Why? Why? Because she's a black woman taking charge of her business. She's a woman taking charge of her business. She's an artist taking charge of her business. And Madonna led the way." Want to talk more about the influence of Madonna in just a moment. But Kimberly Adams, I know you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I think one thing that's important to keep in mind when we talk about the power and control of Beyonce is also to keep in mind what we don't know about it, because you have to imagine if somebody comes to you and says, "Hey, would you like the opportunity to work with Beyonce? Sign this NDA and you get to work with Beyonce." How much power does then the other artist have? How much authority? How much freedom? I mean, and in an ideal bubblegum world, we're going to assume that because we all like Beyonce, or at least most of us, you know, right, that it's all fine. But on the other hand, when you do have someone with that much control over their image, over everyone who's working with them, over who communicates about them and their work, you do have to wonder just how much power anybody else in that situation has for their own creative input.
Candace, regarding the critiques that Beyonce gets regarding, you know, the capitalistic nature of it, for better or worse, you know, regardless of how one may view it individually as a fan, I wonder if you could respond to a comment from Astrid, who wrote on our website, the1a.org, "I love Beyonce, but wonder what the effect of her parents having economic means has had on her career. She grew up firmly upper middle class, I think, and that must have had some influence on her ability to rise to stardom. Also, I have sometimes found her feminism uncomfortable until recently, when she seems to have really grown into a role calling out racism and inequality. Love her." Candace?
Yeah, I think... Well, first, the issue with capitalism. I think that anytime we have conversations about capitalism, black folk, and particularly, especially women of color, cannot be our starting point, right? So, mm-hmm. So we have to, if we are going to critique capitalism, if we're going to critique the ways in which black people have to find ways to survive in these spaces, it cannot be. Our critiques of capitalism can't start with us. And so even saying that, I do think that it's important to acknowledge that, yeah, there is a way that she has come from a certain level of comfort, but it's very easy to reduce, if we're not careful, the success that she has had to that. Because there, I mean, we can look to many artists. I mean, we can look to hip hop, in particular, and see the converse, right? That there are artists who came from stories of literal rags to riches. And are some of the highest paid and most wealthiest African Americans currently. So there's a way that if we focus purely on access, I think that we lose a larger conversation that's really necessary. But to push back a bit on the conversation around her feminism, and I say this to my students all the time, is that feminism, black feminism for many people is complicated, right? That when you have black women, when you have women of color, our feminisms will be as nuanced and as complicated as we are, right? So I use the example of a man can never come up and call me a bitch, right? Mm-hmm. But there are songs that hip hop songs that I listen to that may, if you saw me dance in the club, you might side eye me, right? That
because that word is there.
Yes, right. So there's a complication to the ways in which it may play out within our ethics and within our daily activities. But I think that what is important to note about Beyoncé is that within her professional ethics, within creating, long before we got the surprise album, shifting to an all-female band, mm-hmm. right? Ensuring that there were people of color and women of color and people of diverse, lived experiences working for Parkwood in front and behind the camera, I think speaks to the ways in which she is trying to articulate, a kind of feminism and a kind of intersectionality that is both reflective of what society looks like, but mm-hmm. also very much honors the way that she is steeped in her own family context, right? Not someone who a lot of people want to assume that she, you know, came out of this vacuum and has absolutely no cultural context. And we know, I mean, even if we look at her music previously, we look at the work that she's done, and we look at some of the work that's come out of her family with mm-hmm. her sister, that she's not someone who came, you know, is clueless about her work and her worth in the world.
Well, and it is worth noting that her place in the world as a black woman is certainly something that that a number of our listeners are commenting on in an array of ways. Angela tweeted, Beyoncé and Serena Williams talking about their experiences as black women during pregnancy and labor has massively increased awareness of the terrible infant and maternal health issues affecting the African-American population. True, Angela. Some of that we discussed on this program during our week of programming beyond Mother's Day. Brenner emailed, I could not wait to get the Vogue issue. I love that she spoke for herself in the issue and didn't allow anyone else to describe her or define her. It was so refreshing. Her authenticity, strength, vulnerability, fearlessness, intelligence, and honesty are a model for all of us, especially women. Her model of loving and caring for herself and being gentle with herself and her body after becoming a mother are so important. Fridera Hadley, I wonder if you can respond to this email from Alden, who writes, to speak of many of the issues that you say Beyoncé is trendsetting in, such as ownership and control of her brand, you have to pay tribute to another artist. Prince. From his first album, the music was written, composed, arranged, and performed by Prince. Later, he famously fought Warner Brothers for ownership of his masters and wanted to be known for his saying that if you don't own your masters own you. Fridera?
Yes, I think when we talk about Beyoncé, there are two pieces of context that are really important. Beyoncé is a student of both artistic inspirations and business inspirations. She has paid attention to how the industry has treated black artists since its inception, and she has astutely avoided many of those pitfalls that artists like Prince and even Michael Jackson had to push back against. I don't think we really have an appreciation for how much people like Michael Jackson, Prince, Whitney Houston, Janet Jackson, and even if you go back all the way to the blues eras, people had to push against just to create the art. Even before that, minstrelsy, quite honestly, to create a space for themselves. That has been the story of the recording industry. So that's one thing. Two, I think we need to really appreciate how long Beyonce has been in front of us. She's been in front of us as a major music figure since 1997. That she says 21 years. And she has had an upward trajectory from that moment until now, and who knows where she'll be going forward. So that context is really important. And so I think she absolutely talked to people. I've heard that she's talked about having conversations with people in order to understand how to navigate the industry. And so taking that control of her business and creating Parkwood, I think, is just as much an acknowledgement of how she does not trust big management companies to manage her as a black woman. It doesn't matter how many Grammy Awards she's won. It doesn't matter how many records she sold. It doesn't matter how much her tour's gross. At the end of the day, I think there is a primal understanding that she's still viewed as a black woman, no matter how many mouths she's feeding, no matter how many people she's supporting. And so in founding Parkwood, and she had a major shakeup in 2016 before Lemonade, she rebuilt her entire team, and her COO is a man named Steve Payman, who graduated from Morehouse and, you know, came from Chase and has experience in sports and entertainment.
Morehouse, a historically black college.
A historically black college, but is steeped in all of that culture, but also shares her ideology about where she wants to go and understanding how there is no worn path for this capitalist record media industry to afford the kinds of rewards that Beyonce has justly earned to her. And so therefore, they're going to have to fight to earn and maintain all that she deserves because of her work ethic and her proven artistry and all of that. Well, they understand that they will always be playing a bit of offense and defense. And I think that context is really important.
Yeah, I do want to get a little bit more into that. And Kimberly Adams, maybe we should zoom out a little bit and give some context. We talked a lot about all these different business interests that Beyonce and her enterprise have footholds in. Can you paint us a clearer picture of what this landscape looks like? You know, if I'm an artist and I have to deal with an array of different players to get an album out, or an array of different players to make a concert tour happen, or an array of different players to get any kind of a video project done. Can you give us like a 30,000 foot view of what these different kinds of players are, just to contextualize this a little bit more?
Well, I mean, what you're really talking about is the array of different things that it takes for an artist to make money
right.
in this current environment.
Right.
And it is a lot harder for a musician to make money today than it used to be, because you're probably not selling CDs or records or albums to millennials or Generation Z or anybody else. They're going to be streaming that music. And the streaming model doesn't necessarily net as much income. And then that gets, you know, divided up in so many different ways, whether it be the label, the production company, the artists, the writers, the producers. Everybody gets a piece of it. So this is, you know, sort of what was behind that big Taylor Swift Spotify boycott. You know, how will artists make money? And Beyonce has a big stake in the Tidal company, which was started by Jay-Z, her husband.
And we should be clear, since you mentioned Taylor Swift, where we're talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, is that when you buy an album or when you buy a track, the artist gets a cut of that. But what services like Spotify have negotiated to give the artist every time you stream it is not even pennies on the dollar. It's like hundreds of pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, depending on the artist and depending on the deal. But it's definitely less than you might make if the only way your income is coming in is through radio plays or album sales. So taking that context into mind, you look at Beyonce, who in many ways has pioneered different ways for artists to monetize their content. For example, the visual album. You know, people were floored when this visual album was dropped by surprise on iTunes, and it made a lot of money. Now, have other artists been able to duplicate that in the same way? Not necessarily. I mean, Lemonade was definitely the next big one that came, even though other artists have tried. But That, as well as this huge production of the tour. And she's making, what, $5 million a night with Jay-Z on the On
Not
the
bad.
Run 2, two tour? And, you know, paraphernalia and merchandise as well.
Tim wrote on our Facebook page, this SNL piece on white people finding out Beyoncé is black is spot on. I am a middle-aged white man, and I couldn't be happier that you're talking about Queen B. Love her and a break from all the noise. Well, we love you too, middle-aged white guy. We will talk about that SNL piece when we get back. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program about North and South Korea. Technically, the Korean War never ended, but both countries are acting more peacefully toward each other now than they have in a long time. Talks are underway to create more cultural and economic ties, and there have been some reunifications of families split by the 38th parallel. How do the Korean conflict and the prospect for peace affect you personally? Leave us a voicemail. 855-236-1A1A. Are you or your family watching the Korean Peninsula closely these days? What are you watching for? And what would a lasting peace mean for you? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our new app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio-quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. We'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Kimberly Adams, Candace Marie Benbow, Soraya McDonald, and Friedera Hadley. LaShonda wrote on our website, the1a.org, Beyoncé's music has somehow become the soundtrack for my life, dating back to the Destiny's Child days during my middle school years to being an educator of the exact same age group today at 33 years old. There was a mention before we paused about that SNL sketch about Beyoncé. It's been said by some that Beyoncé is embracing her blackness more in some ways. And Soraya McDonald, I'd love to hear from you on that. But first, let's play a piece of that skit from Saturday Night Live.
It was the day white people lost their Beyoncé.
Getting word now that Beyoncé isn't the only black celebrity. Some are saying Kerry Washington may also be black.
No, it can't be. She's on ABC.
I don't understand. How can they be black? They're women.
I think they might be both.
Part of that Saturday Night Live sketch about white people discovering that Beyoncé is black. I have to say that as a black man hosting on NPR, I almost can't laugh at this. It's almost too close to home. But
that's real life.
It's real. Whew, Lord, it's the life don't get no realer. But I should say that not everybody found this kind of storyline funny. Here is a clip from conservative commentator Tommy Lahren.
Beyoncé didn't reference the Black Panthers to bring about some kind of positive change. She did it to get attention. Good for you. You made headlines. You, just like President Obama, Jada Pinkett Smith, Al Sharpton, and so many others, just can't let America heal. Keep ripping off the historical Band-Aid. Why be a cultural leader when you can play the victim, right? Guess what, Beyoncé? White people like your music, too. White people buy your songs on iTunes, memorize your lyrics, and admire your talent and beauty. Little white girls want to be like you just as little black girls do. But instead of recognizing that, you would rather perpetuate the great battle of the races. Your husband was a drug dealer. For 14 years, he sold crack cocaine. Talk about protecting black neighborhoods. Start at home.
A clip from conservative commentator Tommy Lahren. We also heard from one of our listeners who tweeted, just because something is a cultural phenomenon doesn't mean it's good. It seems like because she is a black woman, she is above critique because it's not PC. Soraya?
Oh, boy.
I know, there's lots to unpack there. Go.
Go in, okay.
But I understand what the listener is writing on Twitter. I kind of see where Tommy Lahren's going, and I think that was one of the critiques. And I was in San Francisco for Super Bowl 50 when Beyonce performed Formation. I get the critique, this idea that she would take the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panthers, whether she genuinely meant that as a cultural statement, whether it was just like a time peg that she was exploiting for effect. Like, I heard both from people in the Bay Area in reaction to her performance. So I get it. I think I see where the debate is.
I think this is really frustrating. So on the one hand, with this SNL sketch, you basically have you have white people who have sort of woken up to the idea that Beyoncé is black. Beyoncé's been black her whole life, right? And it's clear from the words of her mother and her sister, especially if you listen to Solange's album, A Seat at the Table, and the way that Tina talks about how she raised both of her daughters to always be proud of their blackness, that this is, you know, this isn't something that she just came to. I think one of the things that we see in sort of these critiques of the way that Beyoncé sort of expresses her blackness in public performance and in music is that, like, this is something that has evolved for her the way it does for most people. You know, I don't really know anybody who sort of comes out of the womb, like, spitting critical race theory, like, you know, like they just got a PhD in it. You know, this is something that is sort of built up from reading, from lived experience, from listening to other people, from learning about your history. Mm-hmm. And this idea that Beyoncé is somehow capitalizing on the Black Panthers, I think speaks to an ignorance of the way that she's paid homage to other artists and folks who have come before her, period. And the other thing is that this idea that somehow bringing up or honoring the Black Panthers is dividing the country, I just find really curious. You know, I mean, when you think about this, one, you know, we can talk about the Panthers as sort of basically providing the groundwork for the modern gun rights movement. We can talk about the way that we can talk about COINTELPRO. We can talk about how the murder of Fred Hampton basically sort of provides this framework for basically like state-sanctioned murder of black people.
Soraya, I hate to cut you short. I do want to get in a few more comments. I'm really sorry to interrupt you, but I do want to give a little bit of context that when we were referring to the gun rights movement, I think what you're referring to is the Black Panthers openly carrying weapons and the state of California passing a law in response to them to prevent the open carry of firearms because they carried their firearms openly where no such law existed before. I would like to hear from Fridera Hadley on this, and then there are a few other things I'd like us to discuss before our time is short. But Fridera, let me also throw in, with regards to race, one more comment from a listener. Andrea emailed, as a dark-skinned black woman, I can say that initially I did not feel like I really related to her and her impact. But recently I've been practicing left to right with my 5-year-old son when we're driving. The other day he said excitedly, Mommy, I heard a song about the left and the right. It said, to the left, to the left. Was she practicing her turns to Mommy? Her impact is obviously limitless. Fridera?
Yes. There are two issues to quickly unpack. One is racism, and I'll touch on that. And the second one is that of colorism as well. And we're on the radio, so you all can't see me, but I am also a dark-skinned black woman. And so that's an issue that I constantly think about as well. But going back to the racism piece, I think in the SNL sketch, what that sketch is touching on, smartly touching on, and what Beyoncé has been able to navigate is built on this assumption that we have in this country where black people's access to power, to money, to education is often predicated on how well black people can either code switch or assimilate or replicate what we view of as whiteness. And the music industry is not immune from that. And so pop artists, which as a label literally just means music that sells to white people, there is a implicit contract that artists who succeed in that realm will not wear their blackness and perform their blackness. I don't mean an artifice. I mean like how they choose to incorporate their blackness into their art in a way that would not read as offensive to those audiences, and constantly remind them that they are black, not just in, you know, physically black, but ideologically aligned with issues that affect black people.
Although, so, Fredera, I should, I'm curious about that, because I've always heard that 70% of rap music consumers are white. And right. I think about that sketch from Chappelle's Show where you have Clayton Bigsby, the blind white supremacist who doesn't know that he's black. And he right. pulls up to a car that's playing hip hop music, and there's two white guys in the car. And he starts yelling and calling them all these awful racial slurs and calls them the N-word, and they speed off. And one white kid looks to the other and says, "Did he just call us the N-word? Awesome!" And they high five and they drive away. Like, this idea that there is a color of, there's blackness is both a color and a culture. And this notion that the work of artists like Beyoncé lets mainstream audiences in on the lived experience of black people, the political lived experience of black people, is part of the controversy, but it's also the selling point. It's why that music works economically, though, isn't it?
Well, it's complicated. That's the short answer to everything, right? Hip-hop is the same and different at the, simultaneously. Yes, it had, and all of this music, the irony of it is, all of, if we look at any genre, blues, rock and roll, it always had strong white audiences, always had strong white support, even if people were talking about their experiences. But the question then becomes, how does it confirm what white audiences already think about black life versus black music that challenges and points fingers and advocates for the improvement of conditions that affect black life? I think that part is part of the equation that's also important. And even if we look at hip-hop, despite its astronomical success, we still see ways in which it is marginalized at the Grammy Awards and certain issues that certain periodicals that cover music still facing questions of legitimacy, despite its astounding amount of success among right. global audiences and white audiences as well.
Stephanie tweeted, "I appreciate Beyoncé's success." And I wonder, Candace, if you could respond to this one. Stephanie tweeted, "I appreciate Beyoncé's success. My only question would be why you dance and dress so sexual. If I still had young sons and a young daughter, I would shelter them from this visual. We had a few comments criticizing Beyoncé's image as part of her brand. Here she is talking about her sexuality after having a child.
You can have your child and you can still have fun and still be sexy and still have dreams and still live for yourself. I don't at all have any shame about being sexual, and I'm not embarrassed about it, and I don't feel like I have to protect that side of me, because I do believe that sexuality is a power that we all have."
And I wonder, Candace, if we could roll that question about sexuality into another question about another woman who became an icon in the music industry. Amy asked, "How much did Madonna's control over her career influence Beyoncé? We know from when Beyoncé started her company, Parkwood Entertainment, that she wanted to, in her words, follow the footsteps of Madonna, be a powerhouse, have my own empire. How much does all of that wrap in together?"
I'll quickly say I'm having a really hard time finding any way to say anything positive about Madonna after her, the way she found, the way she chose to honor Aretha Franklin on the MTV Awards. But
yeah,
but I will say that even Madonna's unapologetic sexuality caused such sparks, such controversy within music and the music industry. But there's something about black women owning their sexuality and owning their bodies. Our bodies are never supposed to be ours. They are supposed to solely be for the pleasure of others. And when we have any kind of autonomy over ourselves and over our bodies, it becomes problematic, right? So you see a Beyoncé or even Rihanna to an extent, who has had to come out and say, you know, I'm not necessarily a role model. I didn't come into this industry to be your daughter's, you know, role model. I think that it's important for mothers of daughters to raise their children, to raise their daughters the way that they see fit, mm-hmm. but to also embrace and teach their daughters that part of feminism, part of the freedom that women are continuously fighting for, is the freedom for women to express themselves however they choose. And there is an inherent freedom when Black women, particularly Black women like Beyonce, such as Beyonce, utilize and walk in that freedom.
One more thing I want us to discuss before we're out of time. And Kimberly, I wonder if you could react to this. There was an episode of the podcast Still Processing where they discussed the use of the term genius and who gets to be called a genius. Here are Wesley Morris and Rembert Brown talking about that term genius from the podcast Still Processing.
One thing that is clear when we think about a Donald, when we think about a Kanye, it's almost like if you go above and beyond what people think you're capable of, suddenly that genius term gets thrown around, like mm-hmm. pretty liberally, I feel like, for Black men. When's the last time, like, after one piece of art or one work, a Black woman has been like just like pretty like universally thought of as a genius? It just doesn't happen.
SZA, genius.
No,
that didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
Right.
You know, it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't happen to Beyonce. And it's like, what more does she have to do on this earth for her to be regarded as a genius? It's like, no, she's just the hardest working woman in entertainment.
Yes. She's a mule.
Yeah.
She's not a magician.
Wesley Morris and Rembert Brown from the podcast Still Processing. Kimberly Adams, what about that? There's no denying that she's at the top of her game, but from a business perspective, in terms of getting the credit she deserves, in terms of more doors being able to open for wherever she wants to go, what about that, this idea of being acknowledged as a genius?
So I think the term genius in particular is interesting in that it rarely gets applied to women more broadly, and definitely not women of color, when it might apply if you equalize the standards across the board. But I think especially when you're talking about women of color, the standard in the United States is that you will not be acknowledged when you are doing amazing work, or it will be seen as the exception rather than the rule. So you almost get the worst of both worlds. Either it's expected for you to go above and beyond, and therefore it doesn't qualify as genius, or God forbid you do something utterly amazing, and then it's like, oh, well, this one person, only because they went so far beyond the standards we would set for someone else, will they be acknowledged as a genius. And in the business context, you know, Beyonce doesn't need it anymore. This acknowledgement that anybody else might seek for something, she doesn't need it. And I think her recent work and recent actions are evidence of that.
Kimberly Adams, senior reporter with Marketplace. Candace Marie Benbow, freelance writer and educator. Soraya McDonald, culture critic with The Undefeated. And Fredera Hadley, a visiting assistant professor of ethnomusicology at Oberlin College. Thank you all for spending this hour with us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.